There you go. There are your numbers. There's the countdown. Yeah. Welcome back to the World of Wisdom podcast, Nora Bateson. This is such a privilege to get to do again. Thank you for coming back. And
I'm so happy to be back, because sometimes when we do these podcasts, I feel like we're just always at the surface. We start at the starting line over and over and over again. And there's a need to keep going, to get to the depth, to find a place where there's a different kind of familiarity with this world that we're working with here. And so I'm happy to come back and go a little deeper this time.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really looking forward to it. And I think what we talked about, both as an intention last time, but also now, it seems even more relevant probably than we imagined that it would be, is this idea of a different way of attending to problems, perhaps, or issues. And that is your concept of meeting and not matching problems and issues. And I think I'm just going to kind of hand it over to you to bring us into the idea, and then we'll see what we can weave from there. Does that sound like a good?
Yeah. Okay. That sounds good. It's hard to know really where to start. So I think I'd like to start in just a very practical place with this. And just talk about what it means to match. And because that's where our familiarity and our habituated way of identifying a problem and thinking about a solution to that problem that is addressing the problem. And so you get this with everything from, you know, a health scare to ways of thinking about social issues, poverty, racism, ecological problems, also, you know, particulate in the sky, etc. So this idea that you can identify the problem and respond directly to it. Mm-hmm. And this thing is coming from a long period of time of actually perceiving the world in terms of mechanistic processes. Okay, when something goes wrong with your car, you replace the part. What's the problem? Well, it's your distributor. Okay, so we either fix the distributor or we replace it. But in a complex living system, you can't just do that. And the reason you can't just do that is twofold. On the one hand, you're looking at a problem, and the problem is, in fact, a consequence of a lot of conditions that are in motion producing a situation. They're not static. So there's that piece of it. The other side of it is that there is a lot of compensatory, okay? All of these other processes around a situation are compensating. So if you twist your ankle, you use different muscles to move. You are going to actually spend a lot more time sitting on the couch and keeping that foot up. Your household members are going to be actually doing some serving for you. You are not going to go on that hiking trip. You're not going to go jogging. You're not going to be taking up that time on the treadmill. You're not going to, there's all these compensatory processes that start to move in. And you can look at this from a lot of different contexts. So I'm listing contexts that might seem to be unrelated to give you the ability to switch contexts, right? So when we go from a health scare to, people who are committing hate crimes against each other, to ecological threats, to family life, we're looking at different types of systemic processes. And what's important about this is, how do you respond to a systemic issue? And because there has been such a long period of time of working with mechanistic processes, the idea is pretty deeply ingrained that you can solve a problem at what you would call, what we might call, the first order.
Yeah.
Okay, at the first level that you see it, in the first place. Okay, so an example of a first order solution would be something like, you have a cut on your leg and you give it stitches. Okay? And in that sense, a first order solution is great. What are you doing? You're closing the cut so that it doesn't, you don't bleed out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? First order solution works in that case. But then when we have other sorts of situations, let's think about, for example, let's say you have a kid in school who's not thriving. And what you might be tempted to do is to just bring those grades up. They just have to do well on the test. So we have to get them ready for the test.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process of just getting them ready for the test, the child is learning that their experience doesn't matter, that the pain they're carrying or the fear they're holding is unseen. And so they may withdraw from relationships that then they will need later on when they are dealing with issues of, you know, the hard issues of being in adolescence, etc. And those relationships have been steamrolled. They've been lawnmowered in the effort to just do well on the test. You just have to sit in your chair. You just have to do well on the test.
Yeah.
And in that process, there was compensatory response. The child starts to see relationships differently, starts to see, have a different idea of their own identity, begins to see school differently, so begins to have a different relationship with not only their parents, but their parents' friends, and their relationship to time. They may lose their play dates. They may, you know, get distanced from their friends, and their best friend suddenly can't hang out with them, so they're with another friend. So they lose that closeness. So these things can reach wide and far, and they can, that moment in someone's life can actually manifest decades later in their inability to actually be in a partnership in a way that is nourishing and tender for the person that they actually do love and want to be with. Okay, so what we're talking about is the difference between what's called first order, you just got to do well on the test, and what's called nth order. And it's called nth order because nth is a term, you know, to the nth degree, we say in English. But just to get this clear, nth refers to this kind of infinite recursiveness.
Yeah.
So there's something that leads to something that goes to something that goes to something. Sometimes it's called a knock-on effect, externalities. But what is recognizable is that when you're working with systemic processes, you are not going to get a linear, definable, measurable outcome. Okay? Because if you are working with systemic processes, this nth order effect, the communication that changes the communication, the relationship that changes the relationship, keeps rippling out. So you don't know where it stops. So the very notion that you can define an outcome of a systemic process is inherently flawed. You cannot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
so, yeah.
So, because there's one thing that just wants to be said here from sort of the, again, in terms of course, I'm speaking from my cultural conditioning, but then there's like one side of me when you were speaking of the child and this thing that you do as a parent to be able to fix the problem that's immediately in front of you. and it leads to all these other things. And there was like a little voice in my head saying, oh, so you're saying it's my fault that, you know, and there's the other thing that was also there, the opposite side of that. It's like, but how do I get to take credit for? And so there's like those, and it sort of, I just wanted to highlight that, you know, we have to maybe look at consequences differently, or like these causal chains a little bit differently as well. That there's something.
I think what you're getting at is what is called agency, right? And so your agency, but what's another word for agency? It's like the ability to do action, right? And so this is really what I think this whole meet not match thing is about. Is how do you become familiar in your perception with seeing the conditions and the moving processes, so that when you take an action, your action is an action that allows those relationships to shift instead of an action that is only to solve the problem.
Yeah.
Okay, so action that is only to solve the problem is first order. And what we're talking about is, what is action or agency at nth order? What does it mean to be able to contribute to something that allows lots of relationships to shift simultaneously? And that really requires a different kind of perception, because you're right. Okay, there is this problem in the middle of this, which you have identified beautifully, which is this individual who is either in a state of mea culpa, it's all my fault, or mm-hmm. I am the hero mm-hmm. who made it all happen, give me credit. Mm-hmm. And of course, neither of those hold any water when you look at how an ecological relational process comes to be. Okay, so let's look at that for a second. Okay, let's say you quit smoking. Okay, and that is something that we very often were accustomed to looking at, that being something that requires willpower, that is an achievement. You just have to claim your life. It's your body. It's your life. It's your family. Just do it, right? But if you've ever been a smoker, what you know is that it's not as easy as it sounds. And likewise, you know, kicking use of petroleum or social media or, you know, other things that have become habituated in our behaviors are not easy to let go of, because there's lots of things wound into them. All right. The smoking is not just the smoking. The smoking is attached to different habits of the day, different ways of thinking about time off, different ways of being, you know, going outside. It's, you know, connected to coffee. It's connected to going out and having cocktails. It's connected. So it is in a transcontextual relationship. There has been a learning into which the smoking has wound its way in multiple contexts. Okay. Like an ecology.
Yeah.
So when you quit smoking, where does the strength come from? Where does the quitting come from? Does it come from, you know, just, well, I've just had enough. I just got a diagnosis of this or that, very occasionally. You know that on every pack of cigarettes, there's horrific pictures of what it does to you. That doesn't seem to matter. They cost a lot of money. And so people are spending far too much money on that. That doesn't seem to matter. We all know it's bad for you. That doesn't seem to matter. So where is this thing? Is it something in childhood where there was somebody who helped you feel a love for yourself that you're able at some later point in life to find again? Is it a relationship to your children? Does it come from an accumulating, gradually coalescing process into which at some point you are ready. Mm-hmm. But where does the readying come from? Mm-hmm. It's not actually that easy to point to what makes somebody ready to make a big change. I think that's a good example of, you know, where is the action? And the action may have been 20 years ago in the way that somebody held you on their lap when you were little and looked in your eyes and you felt seen. You felt like you were really alive and present on this earth with others. And that feeling comes to be something decades later that you can draw from when you need to claim your aliveness. But it's so far from the picture in the moment of, yeah, well, it's New Year's Eve and I quit smoking.
Right.
Right? So this agency is kind of paradoxical because on the one hand, you are you. I am me. And you are uniquely you. Your experiences, your world is uniquely yours. And my experiences, my world, I mean, even all the things we've shared, which are many in terms of basic cultural patternings, we've lived into them differently. So in that sense, the way that you taste something, hear something, do something, write something, say something, dance, move, play music, whatever it is going to come with your fingerprints all over it, right? And people will know, oh yeah, I can hear that that's Amit playing. They know, right? You can hear three or four licks of a guitar solo and know that it's Keith Richards, right? So in that sense, you are you, and you do have what you might call responsibility. Mm-hmm. And then there's the paradox, which is that where did that come from? And if you look at all of the things that make you you, they're all contextual. You know, you've got your DNA, you've got your family, you've got your culture, you've got your education system, you have your, you know, your socioeconomic positioning, the way you lived, the way you ate, the way you were cared for, the heartbreaks that you had, et cetera, that are all contextual. So are you you? Or are you your context? And so I think it's really important not to solve that, okay? And many traditions throughout history have teased this question of, you know, where are you an individual and where are you mm-hmm. not? Mm-hmm. But I think it's in the teasing of that paradox that you begin to get a little bit of insight into what it means to think about how what you say, what you do, how you move, what you don't say, what you don't do is actually contributing to much larger worlds upon worlds upon worlds of responsiveness. What's happening there? And why does it matter? Okay, now let's go back there, because it matters if the problem that we're trying to solve has been identified at a level of first order response. Unfortunately, the questions that get asked, the projects that get created, the efforts to solve said problem are misconstrued. And not only is that a confusion, it's actually dangerous because it goes on to create what is often called unintended consequences. But in the case of where we are right now, it's creating a polycrisis. Okay, so we have a economic system that's generating an ecological system that's continues both of them together are generating a political crisis. Between the political crisis, we've got a cultural crisis. In the middle of that, we have a technological AI crisis. And beyond that, we have a health and mental health crisis from our response to it, which is creating a crisis in the educational world, which is part of the crisis of everything from food to energy to how you raise your kids to even your identity. Mm-hmm. Who are you? What is your relationship to gender? What is your relationship to people who don't come from where you come from, who don't think the way you think, who are, right? So in this moment, this piece of meet, not match, I think is really, really important. And it's one of my struggles is actually to communicate this. How do you communicate it? Because the theory that's under it is heavy theory. It's not something that comes easily into, I like it. It's easy mm-hmm. for me, but it's not that it's easy for me because I'm extra smart. It's easy for me because I have been living with it. It lives in my body now. And, you know, theoretical work doesn't really count until you have it in your body. Not a bunch of ideas to just float around in your intellectual space. This is about living into it. So I guess one example of this that I like to use is to think about the 17 sustainable development goal and the logo for that. And you're probably familiar with it, but for those that aren't, you've got 17 color blocks. And each one says something different that basically identifies some aspect of the poly crisis. Okay, end poverty, end hunger, gender equality, life on land, life in the water, and so on. Education for all, well-being for all.
A lot of good stuff.
All the good stuff. It's mm-hmm. really great. They're all. I agree with all of those issues. But if you look at the logo, it actually says a great deal about what kind of communication and what kind of logic, okay? What kind of logic is the accustomed form of receiving that information? So we see lots of colored blocks. Okay, so that tells us that this is a communication for people who are accustomed to receiving information in categories, separated categories, colorful cubes of separated categories. Now,
I just want to quickly remind us that when you say communication, what you said last time was that it's what's possible to say. It's not what's being said and what's not being said. It's what's possible to say. I just think that's an important nuance to carry in this, what you just said. Because certain things become possible and other things become impossible when you see the world in these colored, categorized, delineated boxes. And, mm-hmm. and other things are very difficult to communicate through that language.
Very difficult to communicate in any kind of language.
Sure.
And metaphor opens things up. So let me go on with this metaphor. So in contrast, if you look at the image of a woman nursing her baby and recognize that as mammals, our survival is contingent upon the ability to feed the babies. Okay. That's what mammals do. They feed their babies. And if you can't feed your babies, that's that for your species. So what does it take to feed the babies? What does it take, okay, for that mother to be able to nurse her child? That mother's body has to be well fed. That mother's body needs to not be filled with microplastics that go into the breast milk. That mother needs to have eaten food and drunk water and breathed air that provide milk for that baby. So that baby's body grows to be able to feed the next generation. And so that means that the family of that mother also need to be able to sleep and live in a way that is safe and healthy, and that the people who make her clothes need to be able to feed their babies, and the people who make the food for the people who make the clothes need to be able to feed their babies in safety and health, and that means that the oceans have to be cared for. That means that the air has to be clean. That means the water has to be cared for. So this is the whole picture is there. But it's there in a very different kind of communication. What's fascinating to me is that sometimes people say, "Oh, Nora, you're so abstract." You know, and I feel like, really? Because I think sure? this is not abstract at all. This seems like really the opposite of abstract. Those colored boxes, that's abstract, my friend. And so what has happened here?
Yes.
That where the abstractions have been transposed, where seeing the way that the natural ecological world responds in multiple, okay, so that in that gesture, there's multiple things happening. The baby is being fed, okay, for these two bodies are generating life together, the mother and the baby. But that's also in relationship to the larger ecology and what the mother has eaten and all of that. It's also in the ecology of relationships that she's in, how much adrenaline and stress she's in. It's also beyond just nutrition and feeding. There's a whole emotional connection. There's an intellectual connection. There's a language communication that's happening there. Often there's song, there's ritual, there's the bundling of the babies, there's the fabrics, there's connection to all sorts of processes that we live within, okay? Just like the smoking, this thing is connected in multiple ways. This is how ecologies work, with multiple connections in many directions. And that's in contrast to this idea that you can end hunger, fix the land and the water, and that those things are separable in any way, shape, or form from how an identity is created, how you raise your children, how you think about, you know, being intimate, how you have breakfast, how we are in relationship with our neighbors, our ancestors, and future generations. Not to mention the many other organisms out there. But it really is baffling, okay? So if I were to say to the United Nations, look, this logo is really misconstrued because it's actually driving people down a road where they're going to ask a lot of questions meant from a great place, fantastic scientists doing really great work, but they're separated. Mm-hmm. And so their efforts become disconnected and in fact begin to erode further those critical relational processes. But if you try to say, look, why don't we focus this on how to nourish the relationships that nourish the relationships that nourish the relationships that become the possibility of a mother being able to nurse her baby? That's nth order. That's ecology. And it is a very different approach to meet the situation, not match it. But the perception of that is counterintuitive, which is a strange word to use because which intuition? Mm-hmm. but it's counterintuitive to that part of being alive in this era that is mixed up in mechanistic response so deeply that even when we are trying to do systemic response, we repeat it. Yeah. Is that clear at all?
there's so much there, and it is clear, but I think a lot of it is, I have a commentary going in my system around like, oh, and that connects to, and this thing, and that thing. And like, there are a lot of subtleties that are kind of falling into place. And then I'm doing some sort of discernment around like, I don't want to interrupt you. And at the same time, I'm like, I want to point to this thing because that might help someone, or like that might be an on-ramp into this type of thinking. Because it's like you say, you're speaking very concretely, and we're not used to, I'm not used to, I speak for myself in ways, but like the way that I've been brought up into this world, I'm not used to really looking at like, these are the things you're speaking to are things that I can actually see. And then there's a sorting mechanism going on in me that says something like, if it was that simple kind of thing, like it has to be more difficult than that. Otherwise we would have kind of figured this out already. Like there's like, you know, and then at the same time, you're pointing to this different perception that's available that I feel like I'm beginning to attain or acquire, where you can kind of be stupid blunt about stuff, and that changes the whole, like, you know, I don't know if you see what I'm getting at, but it's there, it's in plain sight, but it's not seen. It's like visible but not seen type. That's how I feel. So it falls into place when you speak, and I'm like, there's so much here. Like, it's so rich. It's pulling on so much.
It is. It's there. But there is an art to perceiving it.
Right.
And I think there are opportunities everywhere. There's possibility for another sort of response to our otherwise impossible problems. These possibilities are around every corner, but because there isn't any familiarity at this point with this type of response, they're invisible. I think indigenous cultures, ancient cultures around the world have known this for thousands of years. And one of the ways in which they have held this notion of nth order agency was through things like ceremony. And the ceremony might have various protocols in it and sort of series of actions or participations, but the overall ceremony is confirming membership in these processes. And that's not a direct message. It can't be a direct message. It's an indirect message, right? You don't get a membership card. You get 400 trillion organisms that live within you, okay? And they change the chemistry of your body. So that membership, responding to the world around you from a recognition of your membership in life, and that's a very different type of beginning place, where the counter to that is something like, you know, well, what's in it for me? How do I win? You know, those type of questions that are right there in the bone. So the membership that a lot of people hold is membership in a multi-systemic way of living from one day to the next. And that means that I need to be able to go to the hardware store to buy a shovel, even if I want to live off the land. It means that I'm participating. My kids have to go to school. I have to pay taxes. My survival is deeply implicated. So my membership is in another place. So again, I want to offer this paradox because also, obviously, our membership is in the ecosystems, in life and relationship. Our ability to commune not only with each other, but with the world around us. And without that communing, our bodies, our families, our emotional and mental health, our physical expression, a relationship to the water, each other, the generations, etc., breaks. And here we are.
It's like two threads going in my head. One is this Jungian pre-individuation, individuation, trans-individuation, whatever, that sort of ladder that we don't have to get into it, but it feels like we have this deep fear of returning in some way. And maybe this deep fear of, I'm thinking about the piece now that you had in your in the book about being lost and how we can be lost in very different ways, that being lost can be terrifying, but it can also be very exciting. It can be an adventure. Being lost can also be the beginning of an adventure. It can be something that's wonderful and an experience of bonding and getting closer and feeling that membership that you're speaking to in a way. And it can also be something that's like I said, terrifying and you can feel very separate and very out of place and out of order and out of all of it. Depending on where you look at it. But there's something around, I don't know. The other question that was just circling in my head is your question. Is the how can we find a way? Like, where's the, what's the pebble, you know, that makes us stumble and not look under the light, but just look beyond the light or make us fall out into the dark and realize that, you know, it didn't kill us. There's still stuff to be known here, even though we can't see it or something like that.
I think it's, for me, it's a question too of the urgency. Okay, there is an urgency. And that urgency comes with these intersystemic crises that are actually escalating. And they're escalating each other. Okay, so the issues with the economic crises are escalating, the mental health crises are escalating, the problems with school and housing and food, and the ecological issues are escalating, the immigration, which is escalating cultural tensions, which is escalating political tensions, which is escalating, and so on. So there's this inter-escalating going on, what my dad called schismogenesis, but we won't get into that today.
No, but
let's just call it inter-escalating because that's kind of a fun word.
Good.
And so this is an urgent situation to respond to something in a way that does not, even if it were possible to create a functional way to pick this thing apart and you know, whack each mole to fix each thing one at a time, there's no time. Mm-hmm. So there is a need to be able to do this, whether, you know, you can think of it maybe in terms of some of the Asian arts, to respond to multiple situations simultaneously. And in order to do that, you have to perceive that it is multiple situations. So the story that you're talking about in the book about being lost. So this whole meet not match thing, by the way, is from a chapter in Combining.
Yes.
So I recommend that you read the chapter because it's,
I recommend the whole book. Yeah. Deeply.
Thank you. There's a story in this chapter that is about being with my small children in Buenos Aires, which is not where I live and not where I'm from, and getting lost. And we went to visit some friends, and then it was Sunday and there was no way to get home from where we were. So we tried to take the bus, and we got on the wrong bus because we didn't know which bus to get on. And then we didn't have any more pesos. And so then and instead of freaking out, which is, pretty natural response actually, yes, in that moment, I realized that as a parent, this was probably one of the most interesting and important things that I could do with my kids, is be with them while we're lost. Because there's one thing that's going to happen in life, is that one way or another, whether it's emotionally or geographically or existentially, you're going to get lost. So the question about how to get back to where we were staying was one, okay, that's the match, right? How do we get back where we're going? That's one part of this. How do you be lost? Okay, that's the meat. So we went into how do you be lost together. And this was lovely because there was an intergenerational learning and helping and look out the window. Do you recognize anything? And I don't recognize anything. And this bus is going to stop, and the bus stopped. We didn't know where we were. So we went into a little restaurant, and we started a conversation with the guy in the restaurant and made a relationship with him. And then he thought that we were all very amusing and let us pay with a credit card a little extra so that we could get on another bus, and told us where to catch the bus. We got on the next bus. Guess what? That was the wrong bus too. And it began to pour rain, just torrential rain. In Argentina, they call it the inundación. Like, it's just flooding rain. And so finally, we kept moving around, and finally Trevor, my son, looked out the window and he said, "There's the zoo." And we had been to the zoo. So we got off the bus and we walked to the zoo. And when we got to the zoo, we were able to sort of orient in another way. And then we talked to another cab driver and said, "If you can just drive us to this machine, money machine, we can give you some cash and then you can take us the rest of the way." And we finally made it home. Making it home was the least interesting part of the story. What is interesting is that we had to find a way together. And to find a way together meant we had to enter all sorts of relationships we weren't planning on being in. We had to go to all sorts of places we weren't planning on going to. That feeling of standing somewhere and not having the foggiest idea where you are or where to go next. And that feeling to do that with your kids and to have your kids be with their mama in that moment. And no, mama doesn't know where we're going.
Yeah.
Mama doesn't know. And I think so often as parents, we get into this situation of feeling like our children will feel unsafe if they don't know that we can solve the problem. And this story is kind of in contradiction to that, because it's an offering that says, actually, your children will feel more safe with you if they know that you know how to not know where you're going. You know that you don't know. You know that there's a moment when you can learn. You don't have to have all the answers and fake it. Your authority will not be broken by not knowing. And so we figured it out together. And it wasn't about getting home. It was about learning how to be lost and learning how to learn together in that moment and to just like figure stuff out. And all of the the solutions to the problems came from relationships that we didn't ever know existed. So it wasn't really, if you looked at this from the outside, you could think, the solution is to have a proper bus schedule and a proper amount of cash in your pocket and a proper amount of, right? We could have not had this problem if we had just planned better. The reality of life is you're going to get lost. And so plan all you want. And that's nothing wrong with planning. But part of planning is actually knowing how to be lost.
And there's also, something around, I mean, in a way, what didn't get lost was the membership, if you will. And I mean, just to keep using that, that language that you introduced before, but like you were together, and that was, unshakable. And so there's a learning there as well. I don't know if this helps in terms of doing some furthering us, but there's I spoke to someone yesterday who was talking about one of the main traits of the current cultural condition, the dominating culture, the Western sort of modern thing, has to do with entitlement, like an entitlement to know, that we think that we're entitled to know, and that gets in the way of, and that it's been with me as we've been speaking now. And I don't know if that's, is that helpful to bring in?
It's interesting. I mean, it's so destructive. Another piece in that chapter, actually there is the wedding vows. Mm-hmm. So one of the questions that I'm asking in this chapter is, what do you actually want someone to promise you? And if you think about it, this is actually a pretty profound question. And I think it's an important question, not only in terms of your, your life partner, your intimate partner or partners, but in terms of community. What do you want people to promise you? What does loyalty actually entail? And when my husband and I were getting together, we had both been married before. And so we made a lot of vows that obviously...
Right.
So it became really clear how those vows were tied up in property and ownership and all sorts of other systemic ideas that that actually we didn't really want our companionship in life to be based on that. So what do you want someone to promise you? And do you want them to promise that they'll be with you no matter what? And I mean, I actually could not want that for him.
No.
I don't want it for me. You know, if he doesn't want to be with me, I don't want him to be with me. I want him to go be where he needs to be. Would I be sad? Would I miss him? Would I be pissed off? Probably. But ultimately, these are his days of being alive. To love someone is to want them to be alive in the way that they need to be alive. And we all change. So I feel like this notion of I will know what you will do is such a violence to the possibility of people recognizing possibility. Mm-hmm. Things coming into their world and moving them into new places. But it's interesting to note how that can get switched into a sort of selfishness of what about me and my life and my time and my pleasure and my this, as opposed to it coming from that place of offering, I want what I want in this way that our beings are in communication and relationship with each other is for you to know that I want you to live in the way that you need to live. And if that means not being with me, then that's what it means. But there's something in those vows that it was kind of interesting to put our wedding vows in. But, there's a lot in this book that's very intimate, because I feel that it's really important to recognize that these larger global crises are wrapped into the most unseen assumptions that play out in our day-to-day, moment-to-moment minutiae of our intimate lives. So easy to project big models and big political policy changes and so on and so forth, but not so easy to shift the way people live and think and feel. So we had these vows, and we both said to each other, I will promise you these things. I promise to show you my whole self in so much as I can, right? Because how much I'm changing, right? I promise to speak and be in truth with you. I will not hide anything in so much as I can. I promise to learn with you and from you. I will share incomplete ideas and unknown feelings with you so that you will know where I am even when I'm lost. Mm-hmm. I choose you. And that lostness is important. Can we be lost together? Because most of the time we actually are. So that's that meeting, not matching. Recognizing that we're lost is not about getting a better map. It's about what is our possibility of improvising.
Yeah, what's our possibility of improvising together? Yeah. 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 That's beautiful. I think that's perfect for me, unless you want to. Is there something else that you feel should be said at this moment?
Not really. I mean, there's all those things, you know, the map is not the territory, the menu's not the food.
It's all there, yeah.
All that stuff. I think just what happens when you pull things out of the context of the way they're making life and put them in a context of how you make a machine. And that recontextualizing into mechanistic thought is making it difficult to respond.
And there is a way. I mean, I've been in a meditation since we spoke last around that map and like what it actually does, and then kind of accepting that although the territory always wins, and yeah. I know that on some level, I'm still conditioned in this map making, and I'm conditioned in that craft of making maps. And so I have two little, so one part is I hang out with a few mountain guides that are very good at reading topographical maps. And they are, when they read them, they are, I perceive that they are there. So there's a way of reading a map that sort of elucidates something or that allows you to go there. And that's a very different way of relating to the map, as if, when they go there, they still have to make their assessment, but they have a knowing of a part of the reality or of the terrain that allows them to go further or deeper or beyond. Like it brings you in more contact with the territory And so there's, I'm trying to practice that for myself. So now I have this, you know, I've been taught to read maps and that maps are important and so forth. So just to be with that intimately, accepting that, that's the way that I've been taught, allows me to go further, or beyond, or deeper, or to start seeing, shifting that perceptions. And sometimes it just breaks through and there's like this little, there's like a reveal happening, there's contact, and intimacy.
Absolutely. And it's okay. But now if you go out of that literal map into the other kind of maps that we hold, like what it looks like to go through a school system and grow up and get a job and live a life. Okay. We have a sort of a map of what a lifetime should look like. And when the territory doesn't match the map, there's a sense of failure. Yeah. There's a tension. There's a violence to the ability to respond to the emergence, submergence that's there. And that's what we're worried about. I'm not really that worried about actual maps.
No.
Right? No. I'm much more worried about these other kind of maps that say what it looks like to be a successful person, what it looks like to stop world hunger, what it looks like to, and these ways of thinking that get very abstracted. And they're so abstracted from the bizarre ways in which life actually unfolds. Wonderfully weird and unexpected things happen in life that offer possibilities that meet lots of different issues simultaneously. And they get missed. And people find themselves in situations where they're very lonely and in situations where they're doing harm or harm is being done to them. And it's those maps that I'm worried about.
Yeah.
And how to perceive possibility in the territory around the edges of our perception. The maps get so ingrained that it becomes difficult to even perceive outside of them. Right? Like that example with the SDG logos.
Yeah. I agree. And there's what I was getting to, I think, is with the concrete example of the map, but there's a way to cultivate an ability to get excited when you go beyond or below, or like there's an ability to kind of sharpen or heighten yourself when there's a way that you can kind of drop back and shut down and go the other way and stop walking. And so I think even in the maps of life, there's like a, I don't know, there's like a navigation happening, and there's a, it relates to that readying. And then there's intelligence also in maybe sometimes not daring to step off the map just yet, because you might have a deeper knowing or another part of you knows that you're not, you know, you might not be able to handle the forces that will be exerted on you or around you. Exactly. Or so forth. You might not have the support of the system and so forth, but still to continue to go to the edges and yeah. And then sometimes you know, you're Alice. I think we talked about that last time, and you fall through and then you're somewhere else, and it's wonderful and very weird for a while.
And it's also true, right? There are times when, you know, just like with my kids, I knew they had to get through school, and there were things I wanted to fight. You better believe it, because I was looking at the way that, you know, of course, the whole school system is is created around the idea of breaking subjects apart from each other. I mean, how do you learn math that's not music or history or, you know, social studies that is somehow not science and biology? And like, how did this happen that this got so screwed up? But I needed to keep my head down. And so where did I place that relationship and that perception with my kids? I did what we needed to do.
Yeah.
I just didn't do it in a battle with the school. I did it in another context. And so I think that's there too, that even when you are stifled in one context, it's possible to find expression and learning and improvisation in another one. And this is so important to having morale, yeah. Right? So in this moment, it's not hard to lose yourself in a kind of, it's all impossible. I am despairing. I can't stop the war with Gaza or Ukraine. I can't stop the international shipping system. I can't stop the tax system or the, you know, industrial weapons making or the, I can't, there's so much I cannot do. I can't stop people from being jerks to each other.
Yeah.
You know, and there are moments when it's really just thick and horrible. And I fall into the darkness and I don't want to get out of bed anymore. And if you're paying attention right now, I think it's perfectly reasonable to have those days.
Yeah, exactly.
But where, it's not that I'm looking for hope. What I'm looking for is that fire, that connectivity, that life pumping through me that gets me out of bed to meet another day and to bring whatever I can bring to it in my artistry, in my, some days it's nothing more than just getting the laundry done and getting the emails and the taxes done. And that's it. That's all I can do. And other days, beautiful connective processes and ideas and conversations and music happen. And there's not one that's better than the other, but it's that morale to meet it and not despair. And so I think that this whole meet not match thing, if I want to say what it's actually holding for me, is a go around, a possibility. When match doesn't work, there's meat. There's more here. And when you get into that meat place, it's involving a lot of life forms. And I guess I feel like that vitality, that pumping fire in your belly, that communion,
yeah,
will keep us,
yeah,
in membership,
yeah,
as opposed to falling into a Netflix abyss, which is so funny.
That's the other, yeah. You have reaches and then you have Netflix. Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Coming back.
Thank
you. It was
you
really
so
wonderful. Yeah. And this felt important. So thank you.
I'm really glad we got another chance. And enjoy the communication is sacred piece.
Oh yeah, I will. I'm looking forward to it. And that's worth a read for those that are listening. The communication is sacred, and also the book combining. And there will be links again in the show notes to both of them, because it's a transformative read, the combining. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.